Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Today you're going to learn about how curcumin inhibits the primary nucleation of amyloid beta peptide. In lay language, the Medical University of Sofia, which is in Bulgaria, states that yes, we know that the amyloid plaques are a key hallmark for neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and the amyloid genesis is a complex, long-lasting, multi-phase process starting with the formation of nuclear amyloid peptides. And that's what leads to this primary nucleation. So along comes, or the inflammation in your brain, so every time you have something like a soft drink or coffee or alcohol or something that causes inflammation, you're then laying down that primary amyloid beta peptide, which in time becomes like little white streaks, and that is what causes dementia, of which Alzheimer's is one of the conditions. But along comes curcumin, and lo and behold, curcumin, which is a well-known inhibitor of the aggregation of the amyloid beta peptides. Even more, curcumin is able to disintegrate the preformed fibrils and amyloid plaques. In effect, it's like an oversimplification, but it would be like going in and you get some real serious grease and fat build up on a plate and you have to scrub it with some steel wool. That's kind of what, in a rather extended way, that amyloid's doing, curcumin's doing. So that's good news. One more reason, if you want a healthy brain, take your curcumin each day. We have a lot more coming on health and nutrition, but also today, I'm going to go through a lot of different topics, like Americans are becoming climate migrants right here in the United States, an article from The Guardian. And the CDC published an article in the Western Journal, or they didn't publish it, Jack Davis did, but it says that the CDC, quote, comorbidities present in 94% of COVID deaths. I've been saying that for months. Don't just look at the coronavirus. Look at the comorbidities. That determines who's most likely to succumb to or have problems with the virus. Now the CDC is acknowledging that, so we'll get to that. Also, from Global Research, a medical doctor warns that, quote, bacterial pneumonias are on the rise from mask wearing. All right? Dr. James Meehan will give you some information on that. And then we're going to take a look at an interview. We just found it yesterday. Store owner citing 98 cents bread calls health food overpriced, from Grace Lichtenstein, The New York Times. Okay. This was December 9th, 1971, page 37. I'm the person doing the heart of this. I'll explain why. We didn't even know this existed. I'd never read this before. Our archivist just found it. So that's fun. I'll read it to you and show how that's relevant. We have a lot to share today. Plus today, I decided to do another commentary in the form of an article. It'll be posted, or is now, on PRN.fm. It's called Clash of Crippled Ideologies is Leading to the Nation's Demise. Richard Gale and I have written this, and I'll share it with you today. I think it'll put things in perspective. But we begin with the latest on health and healing. I also have comments from a top medical professor at Harvard, top medical professor at Stanford University, and top medical professor at Oxford University, all saying that the lockdowns are wrong. Now, they agree on most things. Otherwise, they want the vaccine. They're very orthodox. But they're telling us this is not a good idea. So you got three of the most respected scientists from three of the top institutions in the world coming together. This is unheard of. So we'll share them. And then we're going to play an additional clip from the lawyer who is leading a consortium of lawyers to file lawsuits because they believe we have been intentionally manipulated, lied to, and about COVID and the pandemic, And so they believe this is going to be bigger than tobacco, asbestos, scandals, Agent Orange. This is big. So I was hoping sooner or later people would involve themselves in this scenario before our entire society has collapsed. That's good news. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. I told you about why you should take curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N. Another study, this is from the VA Medical Center in Detroit. Acupuncture before surgery means less pain and significantly fewer opiates for veterans. This is important because veterans who have acupuncture before surgery report a lot less pain, and they don't need all those opiates, which can, yes, manage their discomfort, but are very addictive. And this was a randomized controlled study, and it's published in Anesthesiology at the annual meeting for the anesthesiologist. So good news, if you're going to have surgery, get acupuncture beforehand. It can make a difference. Also, University of Central Florida published an article about the anti-inflammatory activities of four botanicals widely used as medicines. They reported that extracts derived from holy basil, sesame seeds, long pepper, and what is called cubed pepper can successfully reduce inflammation and prevent other events that could lead to serious diseases. And this was published in the Journal of Medicinal Foods. Now, I'm also suggesting that sesame seeds for most people are not going to be used because they're very hard to digest. But tahini, where you crush up those seeds, yes. And if you notice with tahini, when you open a jar, there's always oil on top. That's a sesame oil. That's good also. Now, of course, holy basil is very easy to get that. And then you can look at the long pepper and the extract from that as a seasoning. And also the cubeb, C-U-B-E-B, pepper. Not difficult to get. These are very, very good anti-inflammatory agents. And they reduce inflammation, which can then help with pain and healing. So all good. Also, they're shown to lower cholesterol. That's also good. Reduce oxidative stress. That's good. So, and why? Well, because when they looked at them, they found that they have a lot of short-chain organic acids. They have phenolic acids and their derivatives. They have piperine, and that's what you find in black pepper. They have eugenol, E-U-G-E-N-O-L, and rosmarinic acid, and flavonoids, and their glucosides. These are all chemicals naturally found in plants. Now, you don't see those when you eat an orange or some blueberries. You could have 100 or more phytonutrients that are good for you. And a lot of these are anti-inflammatory. And there are lots of studies supporting this. So once again, look at functional foods, meaning they function in a specific way. It acts in part as a caloric restriction mimic, and that's good. So, by the way, taurine is really good for your heart. It's what I would recommend, but also it's good with lipid metabolism, and it conjugates bile acids. So all this is good because if you can restrict your calories by anywhere from 30 to 40%, you're going to decrease morbidity, meaning death, of age-related diseases and prolong the lifespan. That's what it means. And this was presented from the Japan Society of the Promotion of Science. So just one nutrient is one piece of the puzzle that can help people. Also from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory comes a study. And it deals with human health, and as they are stating, it's highly dependent upon genetics, yet is also known to be affected by factors in an individual's environment. And these days, that environment is quite stressful. As we shelter in place amid the coronavirus pandemic, anxiety combined with changes in our routines is driving a significant increase in alcohol consumption, suicidality or suicide ideation or actual suicide, lots of arguments and abuses, and some people are also, needless to say, experiencing weight gain. On top of all this, due to recent wildfires, the air in many areas is filled with smoke and hazardous particulate matter. But long before the events of 2020, scientists were trying to unravel the details of how the separate influences of inheritance, meaning your genes and your surroundings, push and pull against one another to govern traits, and including addictive behavior, disease risk. And it makes a big difference. If you're in a healthy environment, you're going to have a healthier epigenetics. If you're around positive people, healthier genetics. If you're around negative people, critical people, angry people, drama queens, people that, you know, wake up each day and looking for something to complain about, negative epigenetics. And these are very important because they can hardwire you to then seek out the company or the companionship of people of a like mind. So you can harmonize for the better or you can harmonize for the worse. And right now, an awful lot of people, no one knows any accurate statistics, are making just consistently bad choices about everything. I mean, everything, right across the board. It's just, it's as if they've given up and they don't care or they don't want to know what the outcome is going to be. They just keep going forward. And if you want to get a good example of that, look at all the people in California. 1,700 communities have said they're in crisis, need help. 9,000 buildings or homes destroyed, lives lost, 4 million acres burned. And this is just the beginning. We're not even through the fire season yet. And now it's coming up to be drought time that will last at least 40 years and possibly as long as 400 years. So you're looking at nothing getting better, everything getting worse, and yet people not moving. Why do you think people won't move out of harm's way? Why do you think people won't use common sense and reason and self-preservation to move before a crisis? Why do you think most people, the vast, vast majority of people, that's my personal experience, yours may be different, but the vast majority of people won't change anything in their life to change the circumstances for the outcome. They just wait for stuff to happen. And then when it does, then suddenly there is a conversation, if they survive. I was just thinking of the people, the musician Buzzy Linhart. He was a very close friend of mine, passed away last year. And I had four friends pass away last year, all told 21 people I've known. I was just thinking about each one and what the friendship was about and how none of them had to die. So why did they? Because people don't change. It is the rare person that not only changes, but doesn't have to be motivated, pushed, pulled, cajoled into changing for their own good. Why? Why do you think? Why do you think that people stay in California until they are forced to leave, where their house burns down and they don't have the insurance to buy a new one, so they go someplace else? Idaho, which is no better, Utah, which is no better, and most of Texas, which is no better, but if they go down towards Austin and East Texas, yeah, it is better. But there are other places they could go that are much more sustainable. Why aren't they doing their homework to see the best places? Why are people still in the wrong place at the wrong time? Why do you think? I'd like to hear from you. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. But what this study is showing us from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and they specialize, by the way, in investigating the instances where genetics and environment are most closely intertwined, but we know that there is a quantile-dependent expressivity. It's a phenomena wherein the genes that predispose people to certain traits are amplified by environmental factors. So if I want to be calm and happy, I'm going to be around trees and water and nature and butterflies. If I'm living in the highly sterilized environment of Manhattan without the respite of getting into nature, That's going to be locked into my cells. And then one day I'll walk down the street with all the noise, the pollution, the grunge, and not even notice it. We maladapt to our environment. That's the epigenetics. We maladapt to the people in our environment. I was just counseling someone this morning, a drug addict, and not a nice person. In fact, there's nothing about this person I like. This is a favor I'm doing to a friend for a friend of mine. And I said, it would really benefit you if you were able to give up the drugs. No, why not? My friends think I'm better off. They like me better when I'm on the drugs. I see. Okay. Now, I could give a lot of explanations as to why that's wrong thinking, but when a person is doubling down on stupid, then they win. So remember, whatever you do in life, you're going to win. If you decide to rob a bank, you'll win. Until you get caught, and you're in prison or dead, and then you lose. If you keep smoking, you win. Eating hamburgers, junk food, you win. In a toxic relationship, you win. Allowing someone to treat you with disrespect, you win. Until you see the consequences of that, then you lose. So everybody wins in the moment, and then they look forward to all that they will lose in the long term. And we don't have the capacity right now as a society to look ahead to see what is the likely outcome of the choices I'm making, especially with health. So like weight gain, you know, how is it that some people will gain weight? Well, because they're eating and they're not eating healthy foods. But is that by accident? No, it's by intent. It's because the epigenetics of how they were conditioned, maybe someone feeding them that earlier on, highly salty and crunchy or soft and sweet, they developed and acquired a taste for that. And then eating fast, gobbling food down, that also is epigenetic. So I remember when I was in San Sebastian during the World Games in Spain, beautiful place, right on the ocean, and it was about 7, 8 o'clock at night, and the restaurants were just opening. And you wouldn't even know there's a restaurant there. Tiny, tiny little sheds. I mean, I'm talking about 100 square feet, some of them, because I went over to look. And then you open it up, and here's all this fresh food stacked up they got earlier in the day. And then they take their time. You got to take at least an hour and a half to have a meal. But you can always tell the Americans, they finished their meal in like, you know, 8 minutes. And everybody else kind of look at them saying, okay, well, they're Americans. Taking your time, the slow food movement was an interesting concept. It just didn't take on in America. The slow conversation didn't take off in America. Slow time for reading and introspection didn't take off in America. All important, but not for us. We're epigenetically conditioned to where our genes program us to never shut up, as if somehow you're saying something relevant. That's rare. Wouldn't it be nice if a person had a meter in their brain so when you no longer could say anything that was important or you'd oversaid things that were unimportant, your brain simply couldn't say anything more. You had to shut up. Most, if you put it in January 1st, by midnight that night, most people would have used up a year's worth of talking about nothing. In any case, go someplace and see how quiet people can be and then go around America and see how hard it is. That's epigenetic. So just understand there's a lot of science behind epigenetics. And finally, from the University of Barcelona in Spain, published in Frontiers in Psychiatry, they found that social isolation increases anxiety and asymmetry in brain atrophy in Alzheimer's disease. So if you want to die sooner with Alzheimer's, be alone. And that's something that we're not dealing with at all. And we should. I had a solution, and I thought it was a darn good solution. I was going to open up the first holistic assisted living center in the United States. Spent 3 years on it. Had it all ready. Had the center, everything. And then someone undermined it. Someone I actually trusted undermined it, so it didn't happen. And the person laughed about it, and I said, well, you do understand there are tens to hundreds of thousands of people that could have had their advanced conditions stopped and reversed and returned to a healthy, happy life. Laugh about that now. People never think about the consequences of their misdeeds. I'm Gary Noll. We are 20 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, we're going to go to a video clip. This is part two of Dr. Rainer Fulmich on the coronavirus scandal. Now, mind you, what he is telling you, if you didn't hear part one, is for months they've been holding, let's say, investigative tribunals with people all over the world, scientists, professors, clinicians, researchers, to try to get to the truth. And this will be about a 10-minute segment. Very important to hear it, though. Back in a moment with part two of what's going on. The mainstream media won't touch this. The mainstream media won't have on any of the people who are being interviewed because they would contradict the official narrative. We don't have a problem providing a forum for contrasting and alternative points of view.
At the end of March, beginning of April of 2020, Mr. Siebert turned to the leadership of his Green Party with the knowledge he had accumulated and suggested that they present these other scientific opinions to the public and explain that, contrary to Mr. Drosten's doomsday prophecies, there was no reason for the public to panic. Incidentally, Lord Sumption, who served as a judge at the British Supreme Court from 2012 to 2018, had done the very same thing at the very same time and had come to the very same conclusion, that there was no factual basis for panic and no legal basis for the corona measures. Likewise, the former president of the German Federal Constitutional Court expressed, albeit more cautiously, serious doubts that the corona measures were constitutional. But instead of taking note of these other opinions and discussing them with David Sieber, the Green Party leadership declared that Mr. Drosten's panic messages were good enough for the German party, for the Green Party. Remember, they're not a member of the ruling coalition, they're the opposition. Still, that was enough for them. Just as it had been good enough for the federal government as a basis for its lockdown decision, they said. They subsequently, the Green Party leadership, called David Sieber a conspiracy theorist without ever having considered the content of his information and then stripped him of his mandates. Now let's take a look at the current actual situation regarding the virus's danger, the complete uselessness of PCR tests for the detection of infections, and the lockdowns based on non-existent infections. In the meantime, we know that the healthcare systems were never in danger of becoming overwhelmed by COVID-19. On the contrary, many hospitals remain empty to this day, and some are now facing bankruptcy. The hospital ship Comfort, which anchored in New York at the time and could have accommodated 1,000 patients, never accommodated more than some 20 patients. Nowhere was there any excess mortality. Studies carried out by Professor Ioannidis and others have shown that the mortality of corona is equivalent to that of the seasonal flu. Even the pictures from Bergamo and New York that were used to demonstrate to the world that panic was in order proved to be deliberately misleading. Then, the so-called panic paper was leaked, which was written by the German Department of the Interior. Its classified content shows beyond a shadow of a doubt that, in fact, the population was deliberately driven to panic by politicians and mainstream media. The accompanying irresponsible statements of the head of the RKI, remember the CDC, Mr. Wheeler, who repeatedly and excitedly announced that the corona measures must be followed unconditionally by the population without them asking any question, shows that he followed the script verbatim. In his public statements, he kept announcing that the situation was very grave and threatening, although the figures compiled by his own institute proved the exact opposite. Among other things, the panic paper calls for children to be made to feel responsible, and I quote, for the painful, tortured death of their parents and grandparents if they do not follow the corona rules. That is, if they do not wash their hands constantly and don't stay away from their grandparents. A word of clarification. In Bergamo, the vast majority of deaths, 94% to be exact, turned out to be the result not of COVID-19, but rather the consequence of the government deciding to transfer sick patients, sick with probably the cold or seasonal flu, from hospitals to nursing homes in order to make room at the hospitals for all the COVID patients who ultimately never arrived. There, at the nursing homes, they then infected old people with a severely weakened immune system, usually as a result of pre-existing medical conditions. In addition, a flu vaccination, which had previously been administered, had further weakened the immune systems of the people in the nursing homes. In New York, only some, but by far not all, hospitals were overwhelmed. Many people, most of whom were, again, elderly and had serious pre-existing medical conditions, and most of whom, had it not been for the panic mongering, would have just stayed at home to recover, raced to the hospitals. There, many of them fell victim to healthcare-associated infections or nosocomial infections on the one hand, and incidents of malpractice on the other hand. For example, by being put on a respirator rather than receiving oxygen through an oxygen mask. Again, to clarify, COVID-19, this is the current state of affairs, is a dangerous disease, just like the seasonal flu is a dangerous disease. And of course, COVID-19, just like the seasonal flu, may sometimes take a severe clinical course and will sometimes kill patients. However, as autopsies have shown, which were carried out in Germany in particular by the forensic scientist Professor Klaus Püschel in Hamburg, the fatalities he examined had almost all been caused by serious pre-existing conditions, and almost all of the people who had died at a very old age, just like in Italy, meaning they had lived beyond their average life expectancy. In this context, the following should also be mentioned. The German RKI, that is, again, the equivalent of the CDC, had initially, strangely enough, recommended that no autopsies be performed. And there are numerous credible reports that doctors and hospitals worldwide had been paid money for declaring a deceased person a victim of COVID-19 rather than writing down the true cause of death on the death certificate, for example, a heart attack or a gunshot wound. Without the autopsies, we would never know that the overwhelming majority of the alleged COVID-19 victims had died of completely different diseases, but not of COVID-19. The assertion that the lockdown was necessary because there were so many different infections with SARS-CoV-2 and because the healthcare systems would be overwhelmed is wrong for three reasons, as we have learned from the hearings we conducted with the Corona Committee and from other data that has become available in the meantime. A, the lockdown was imposed when the virus was already retreating. By the time the lockdown was imposed, the alleged infection rates were already dropping again. B, there's already protection from the virus because of cross or T-cell immunity. Apart from the above-mentioned lockdown being imposed when the infection rates were already dropping, there's also cross or T-cell immunity in the general population against the coronaviruses contained in every flu or influenza wave. This is true even if this time around a slightly different strain of the coronavirus was at work. And that is because the body's own immune system remembers every virus it has ever battled in the past. And from this experience, it also recognizes a supposedly new, but still similar, strain of the virus from the corona family. Incidentally, that's how the PCR test for the detection of an infection was invented by now infamous Professor Drosten. At the beginning of January of 2020, based on this very basic knowledge, Mr. Drosten developed his PCR test, which supposedly detects an infection with SARS-CoV-2. Without ever having seen the real Wuhan virus from China, only having learned from social media reports that there was something going on in Wuhan, he started tinkering on his computer with what would become his corona PCR test. For this, he used an old SARS virus, hoping it would be sufficiently similar to the allegedly new strain of the coronavirus found in Wuhan. Then he sent the result of his computer tinkering to China to determine whether the victims of the alleged new coronavirus tested positive. They did. And that was enough for the World Health Organization to sound the pandemic alarm and to recommend the worldwide use of the Drosten PCR test for the detection of infections with the virus now called SARS-CoV-2. Drosten's opinion and advice was, this must be emphasized once again, the only source for the German government when it announced the lockdown, as well as the rules for social distancing and the mandatory wearing of masks. And this must also be emphasized once again, Germany apparently became the center of especially massive lobbying by the pharmaceutical and tech industry because the world, with reference to the allegedly disciplined Germans, should do as the Germans do in order to survive the pandemic. C. And this is the most important part of our fact-finding. The PCR test is being used on the basis of false statements, not based on scientific facts with respect to infections. In the meantime, we have learned that these PCR tests, contrary to the assertions of Messrs. Drosten, Wheeler, and The Who, do not give any indication of an infection with any virus, let alone an infection with SARS-CoV-2. Not only are PCR tests expressly not approved for diagnostic purposes, as is correctly noted on leaflets coming with these tests, and as the inventor of the PCR test, Carrie Mullis, has repeatedly emphasized. Instead, they're simply incapable of diagnosing any disease. That is, contrary to the assertions of Drosten, Wheeler, and The Who, which they have been making since the proclamation of the pandemic, a positive PCR test result does not mean that an infection is present. If someone tests positive, it does not mean that they're infected with anything, let alone with the contagious SARS-CoV-2 virus. Even the United States CDC, even this institution agrees with this, and I quote directly from page 38 of one of its publications on the coronavirus and the PCR tests dated July 13th, 2020. First bullet point says, detection of viral RNA may not indicate the presence of infectious virus or that 2019 nCoV is the causative agent for clinical symptoms. Second bullet point says, the performance of this test has not been established for monitoring treatment of 2019 nCoV infection. Third bullet point says, this test cannot rule out diseases caused by other bacterial or viral pathogens. It is still not clear whether there has ever been a scientifically correct isolation of the Wuhan virus, so that nobody knows exactly what we're looking for when we test, especially since this virus, just like the flu viruses, mutates quickly. The PCR swabs take one or two sequences of a molecule that are invisible to the human eye and therefore need to be amplified in many cycles to make it visible. Everything over 35 cycles is, as reported by the New York Times and others, considered completely unreliable and scientifically unjustifiable. However, the Drosten test, as well as the WHO-recommended test that followed his example, are set to 45 cycles. Can that be because of the desire to produce as many positive results as possible and thereby provide the basis for the false assumption that a large number of infections have been detected? The test cannot distinguish inactive and reproductive matter. That means that a positive result may happen because the test detects, for example, a piece of debris, a fragment of a molecule, which may signal nothing else than that the immune system of the person tested won a battle with a common cold in the past. Even Drosten himself declared in an interview with a German business magazine in 2014, at that time concerning the alleged detection of an infection with the MERS virus, allegedly with the help of the PCR test, that these PCR tests are so highly sensitive that even very healthy and non-infectious people may test positive. At that time.
Okay, that's part two. You were listening to Dr. Rainer Fulmich on the Corona scandal. He is one of the lead lawyers, international lawyers, criminal lawyers. There's a whole group of these lawyers, and they're communicating with other lawyers all over the world, and scientists, physicians, clinicians, investigators all over the world, that we should not be having these lockdowns, and much of the information about coronavirus is wrong. And he is correct. I've been saying this all along. You cannot use a faulty PCR test to determine viral load or whether or not you're suffering from the current Corona-19 or an earlier coronavirus. You cannot determine whether or not this is a new virus from last week or an old virus from 20 years ago. It is a functionally worthless test. And until such time that an accurate gold standard test is created, all policy made from it is going to be inherently wrong. And that's what they've done. Also, they've been conflating figures. We have this many positive tests. But that could be a completely healthy 18-year-old Olympic athlete who had a cold 3 years ago and they're testing positive. That does not mean that they're actively positive or actively capable of spreading the illness. And yet they're trying to get the public to believe that, which then justifies the politicalization and weaponization of the entire corona debacle. Now, let's just see. Do we have any callers? Waiting to see. No? Okay. Oh, I'm refreshing my email because if we got some, I want to be able to get someone on. We have Yupata from Los Angeles, if that's the proper pronunciation. How do you pronounce your name?
Lupita.
Yupita. Hi, you're on the air. Please share your thoughts.
Good morning, Gary, and your audience. It's a pleasure. Yeah, my thought is that we have so many ties to the community, especially the rest of our family. And I think this is usually why a lot of people are so hesitant, and myself included, why you are not thinking of finding other locations. I really think it's all the ties that you have to your community, to your family. It's something that's really hard to break away from, to separate from.
I understand that, and I believe that you are correct. But that doesn't mean that a person should not try to explain to everyone the benefits of moving for their own protection and quality of life. And that's where you get into the inner family dynamic. And each person is going to have a different way of approaching depending upon the culture and depending upon the hierarchical structure of a culture and who gives the orders to what is acceptable or not. And we are programmed early in life to accept our place within that, whether we rebel or not. Right now, we all have to be rebelling. All of us have to rebel because there's so many different bad things happening everywhere within our society, as you will hear in a second. But I thank you very much for calling in and sharing your points of view. You've made an important contribution to today's show. Thank you, Yupeta. Appreciate it. Americans are becoming climate migrants before our eyes. I'm going to deal with that on tomorrow's program, and then I'll give you my specific suggestions. But right now, a special original insight entitled The Clash of Crippled Ideologies is Leading to the Nation's Demise. One does not need to be an oracle to envision the future. All that is necessary is to examine our constraints and foibles. We are now facing a perfect storm of pain, suffering, and destruction. Financial inequality and poverty, global warming, environmental migration, and disease pandemics. Yet, when any reasonable person questions, what can we do? We are told, we're fine, and the best and brightest out in Silicon Valley are on hand to solve our problems. However, in no small measure, it was the best and brightest during the past 60 years who were the architects of many, if not most, of our crisis we face today. We need to step back and have a purview of the larger picture in order to observe what we as individuals can do to prevent or mediate the catastrophes we will all face. But this begins by reaching an agreement that those in power are the structural problem and can never come up with satisfying solutions. I have not seen any solutions from any of these individuals in the last 60 years. An optimist will say, well, Gary, our social, political, and ecological conditions, well, they'll get better. They'll improve, especially after the election and the real work demanded can begin again. Wrong. The pessimist reflects back upon all the previous administrations since Eisenhower and declares nothing fundamental has changed or can change. We're in a gridlock. The Democrats and Republicans are like two scorpions in a cocktail glass fighting. It will only worsen. The climate optimist says that they're lucky that their home has been not swept away or flooded or burned to the ground from a wildfire or leveled by a hurricane. How lucky am I? For the moment, their lives are safe, so everything will be fine in the future. No, it won't. The pessimist focuses on the reality on what happens when we do not have a national or worldwide Marshall Plan to curb our impending crisis. As one example, this year, 9,000 structures and 4 million acres in California were destroyed in fires as 1,700 towns required emergency assistance. In addition, there were the deadly, what is called the Derecho, D-E-R-E-C-H-O, storms that destroyed approximately 10 million acres in the Corn Belt of Iowa and surrounding states. Throughout the United States, people are waking up to a once-in-a-lifetime experience in our body politic. Others are waking up unknowing whether they will be evicted from their homes and apartments tomorrow. It is estimated that upwards of 75% of restaurants and bars will never reopen again. Yet the sole message fed to us daily by the mainstream media is that the only important issue on hand is to remain fearful of coronavirus, get tested, social distance, quarantine, wash your hands, and trust Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates that they're going to greenlight a vaccine to be distributed across the entire population. That'll save us. Governors, state legislators, and mayors contributing as well, advocating for mandatory mask wearing and testing while imposing strict penalties on those who resist. Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Wikipedia do their best as well to be sure that no medical experts, no advocates, or common citizens with data or facts on social platforms that contradict the official health policies and narratives will ever be allowed. In the meantime, the nightly news, depending upon the political ideology of the network, airs images of either peaceful or violent protests or the latest COVID-19 spin of that day. If the average person asks, what are the top 10 or so issues that our nation and we as individuals should be focused upon, none of them are being discussed or dealt with by anyone in the media or government. The question is, why? It is not as complex or as unfathomable as it might appear on the surface. The basis of Occam's razor is that you cut with a razor through the fat to get at the heart of what you're getting to, meaning the correct answers are generally the simplest. We might begin by acknowledging that we are a nation divided, but we have always been divided to some degree. However, it has never been as purulent and hostile as today. The uniqueness of our society has been our diversity, our languages, cultures, accents, and its ethnic and racial differences. America's dialectic has been one that inspires to become acquainted with these unique differences, such as Southern hospitality, the Pacific Northwest's relaxed and playful lifestyle, the quiet reserve and rural persona of the Midwest, and the frenetic professional energy to succeed in the Northeast and California. And perhaps we appreciate each other in more ways than we consciously realize. Historically, when it was necessary to unite together, we did so as a nation. The World Wars and the Great Depression are but two examples. If we were to ask the average person in the 1930s, what are your priorities? They would be very similar to today: a living wage, a home, food to feed their family, and an educational opportunity for their children. Families wanted their children to be educated and succeed in ways the parents were unable. There have always been conflicting attitudes towards social order or how the nation should be governed. But today, what we are observing is not concerted efforts to advance improvements for how we govern ourselves, but rather we are retreating backwards into tribalism, identity politics, and a new class warfare. No one can predict where this conflict and confusion will ultimately lead. Identity politics, the effort of groups based upon race, social status, gender, or religion to create exclusive political alliances founded on groupthink, has found its scripture on the left in Robin DiAngelo's best-selling White Fragility book. The text, in my opinion, is extraordinarily perverse. It argues that if one is born Caucasian, then racism is built into your genetic inheritance. There can be no escape from this curse, DiAngelo suggests, no redemption or purification by fire, regardless of how much public service one performs for the greater good. If you try to claim that you're not a racist and there's no racism in your family ever, never owned slaves, was against slavery, was an abolitionist, fought the Civil War, it won't matter. They'll say, well, that's proof of your being a racist because you deny being a racist. On the right, we have the identity politics of white supremacism, anti-Semitism, and the fascist Christian evangelicalism built upon medieval superstitions. Contrary to DiAngelo, Melanie Phillips gives us a clearer understanding for why we should not rely upon those pundits who believe that either conservative or liberal truths will save us from ourselves. Neither will. Despite disagreeing with Phillips on many of her other social and political positions, which we do, we believe she correctly on this one identifies the fundamental flaws in the contemporary liberalism now being voiced by Black Lives Matter across our campuses and within the Democratic Party. First, it is unable to establish a hierarchy of values and morals. For example, if one refuses to say that any lifestyle or culture is better than another, then it cannot be said that liberalism is better than conservatism or any other ideology. Consequently, faux liberalism cannot legitimately defend the very principles upon which it defines itself, freedom of speech and religion and tolerance and gender and class equality, etc. It contradicts its own principles and removes the dignity of the individual, which is at the heart of liberalism and serves as its moral backbone. What we are witnessing, therefore, in modern liberalism is the strong dominating the weak. And this is a libertarian ideology that suppresses the facts that contradict it. It is therefore an illiberal ideology. We're against racism, but you're also racist. We're anti-fascist, but you are breaking and destroying property. You are fascistic. We want only one voice and only one freedom of speech, ours. But then you're against the very concept of free speech for all, even if you disagree with that speech. Therefore, that is totalitarian. Sadly, we find highly educated people supporting these irrational and toxic beliefs, as well as elected officials in both parties. On the left are the college-educated young adults who are witless, who are not experienced, and yet are highly sensitive and were raised in protected bubbles with the beliefs that they are exceptional and entitled. These are the ones demanding fealty to Black Lives Matter. On the right are the less educated and the disgruntled working class and disenfranchised dropouts of society who value a perverted libertarian ideal built upon gun ownership. And both have their allies in the mainstream media. You have MSNBC on the left and Fox on the right to provide a bullhorn to the larger public. But both true liberalism and true conservatism, which at one time could and did share constructive dialogue together, have morphed into their polar opposites, an irrational faux enlightenment of liberalism versus a neo-fascist traditionalism that is petrified of the future and wants to turn back the clock. The current speed being measured by the melting of the Arctic ice in Greenland and the recent breakup of the Antarctic ice sheets will sooner rather than later be experienced up and down the Atlantic coastal cities and the Gulf. Nobody in the left or the right, the conservative or the liberal, those marching in the streets, have done a damn thing to stop or address this. They're fighting the wrong battles. Nobody in government is addressing this far greater threat than a virus that seems no more dangerous than a terrible seasonal flu. Amidst all of this noise of protest, identity classes, and coronavirus panic, a laundry list of more serious issues are either being ignored or completely drowned out by the cacophony of overtly emotional hyena cries. how much attention is being given to 66 million Americans now food insecure. They're going to bed hungry. 66 million. Let me give you an example of that. That's more people than live in California and New York combined in the total population. And how about the 2 million who don't have clean water to drink? In the 4 in 10 Americans, that's 132 million Americans who are conservatively financially broke. While everyone awaits a COVID vaccine, which real statistics seem to indicate is medically unwarranted, the comorbid conditions associated with 96% of advertised coronavirus deaths are criminally being neglected. Obesity is the coexisting health risk most associated with COVID-19 deaths. 40% of American adults 20 years and over are clinically obese, and another 72% are overweight. What is being done to free our federal health agencies from the grip, the iron grip, the complete capture of the junk food industry's lobbying? Nothing. To make matters worse, 44 million Americans are uninsured, and an additional 38 million have inadequate health insurance. Approximately a quarter of the population has health coverage well below the standard of any other developed nation. How much of this gross neglect has contributed to the U.S. having the highest percent of world COVID deaths, and what is being done about it? Nothing. And it should not surprise us that the ideological clashes have become so vile and contemptible. But the underlying problem does not reside with the camps facing each other on opposite sides of the street. Rather, our educational system is a disgrace. 43 million American adults, that's 21%, are illiterate or functionally illiterate, according to the National Center for Educational Statistics. So how much of our neglected educational system and the legislation's disdain for teachers is contributing to the civil war many analysts fear is brewing? In conclusion, we have a president who is in a trance of pathological denial about climate change, and then a Democratic contender who thinks he knows something about global warming based upon the corporate polluters and capitalists who whisper in his ear and fund his campaign. Daily new studies are being reported that indicate the climate crisis is far worse than earlier forecasts presumed. Instead of concerning ourselves about what is happening with the migrations, massive migrations that are occurring within our own borders, by the way, 500,000 Oregon residents, about a tenth of the state population, were given an evacuation warning due to an increasing pace of wildfires. But this is not being discussed. And if anyone believes that the U.S. is economically capable of tackling these problems without a catastrophic blowback, you're delusional. The U.S.'s total debt now stands at $82 trillion, $9 trillion more than a year ago under Trump's administration. Mortgage debt, $15.8 trillion. Student debt, $1.7 trillion. Unfunded government liabilities at an astronomical $155 trillion. This is a financial tsunami that can only be curbed by keeping the dollar printing machines going 24/7 until doomsday. In the meantime, other nations will usurp America's former role as the world leader. The big question is whether we have the capacity, capability, let alone the willingness to relinquish our personal dogmas and then individually and collectively step outside of the malignant atmosphere of negativity, hatred, and virtue shaming and begin to address real future threats. That we will discuss on an upcoming program. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.